Chapter 50. Playmate. The reporting on Dylan Howard and the Inquirer opened up a vein. One after another, sources in and around American Media Inc. were calling, saying that Weinstein wasn't the only figure with whom the tabloid empire had worked to suppress stories. Late that November, a lawyer, Carol Heller, wrote to me. There was more, she explained, to a report that the Wall Street Journal had published in the fall of 2016 about a Playboy model who'd signed over to AMI the exclusive rights to her story about a purported affair with Donald Trump, a story AMI never published. Heller told me that the woman at the heart of the mystery, a former Playboy Playmate of the Year named Karen McDougal, was still too frightened to talk. If I could get her and others around the transaction to open up, I might be able to reveal how the contract with AMI came about and begin to unravel how the culture of non-disclosure agreements and buried stories extended beyond Hollywood and into politics. Late that month, I was on the phone with McDougal. She told me the contract with AMI took my rights away. It contained a clause that could allow AMI to force her into a private arbitration process and seek financial damages. McDougal was struggling to make ends meet. AMI could wipe her out.
At this point, I feel I can't talk about anything without getting into trouble, she told me.
Of Trump, she said,
I'm afraid to even mention his name.
But as I gathered more evidence, including her contract with AMI and accounts of how it came about from others involved in the process, McDougal began to share her story. McDougal, who grew up in a small town in Michigan and worked as a preschool teacher before beginning her modeling career, met Trump at a pool party at the Playboy Mansion. It was June 2006, and he was there to shoot an episode of his reality show, The Apprentice.
Come on over,
he said to a couple of models in corsets and bunny tails.
Wow, beautiful.
The show's camera operators zoomed and panned like they were nature photographers and breasts were an endangered species. At the time of the party, Trump had been married to the Slovenian model Melania Knaus for less than 2 years. Their son, Baron, was a few months old. But Trump seemed uninhibited by his new family obligations. McDougal remembered him being all over her, calling her beautiful. Then he asked for her number. The two began talking frequently and, soon after, met for dinner at a private bungalow at the Beverly Hills Hotel.
We talked for a couple of hours, then it was on. We got naked and had sex,
McDougal wrote in notes about the affair that I later obtained. As McDougal got dressed and prepared to leave, Trump offered her money.
I looked at him and felt sad and said, no thanks, I'm not that girl.
Afterward, McDougal
went to see him every time he was in LA, which was a lot.
Over the course of the affair, Trump flew McDougal to public events across the country, but hid the fact that he paid for her travel.
No paper trails for him, her notes read. Every time I flew to meet him, I booked/paid for flight and hotel, and he reimbursed me.
During the relationship, Trump introduced McDougal to members of his family and gave her tours of his properties. In Trump Tower, McDougal wrote, Trump pointed out Melania's separate bedroom. He
said she liked her space, McDougal wrote.
In April 2007, after 9 months, McDougal ended the affair. Learning more about Trump's family had brought on a creeping sense of guilt, and Trump's behavior chafed against her polite Midwestern sensibility. Once, he called McDougal's mother, who was around his age,
that old hag.
On another occasion, as she and one of her girlfriends joined Trump in his limo on the night of a Miss Universe pageant, he started slinging comments about penis size and pressing McDougal's girlfriend about her experiences and preferences, asking about
small dicks and big dicks and black dick.
A friend of McDougal's, Johnny Crawford, first proposed selling the story. In 2016, as they watched election season coverage of Trump, Crawford said, you know, if you had a physical relationship with him, that could be worth something. At his urging, McDougal wrote the notes on the affair. She didn't want to tell her story at first. But when a former friend of hers, fellow Playboy model Carrie Stevens, started posting about the affair on social media, McDougal figured she should talk before someone else did. Crawford enlisted Jay Gardena, the ex-husband of the porn star Jenna Jameson, to help sell the story. Gardena first brokered 2 meetings between McDougal and J.J. Rendon, a Latin American political operative who was already, by then, denying media reports that he constructed fake bases of support on social media and hacked opponents' email accounts. When he wasn't interested, Gradina turned to Keith M. Davidson, an attorney with a track record of selling salacious stories. Davidson got in touch with AMI. Pecker and Howard, in turn, alerted Michael Cohen, Trump's lawyer. Soon, Trump was on the phone with Pecker, asking for help. In June 2016, McDougal and Howard met. Howard then made an offer, initially just $10,000, and then, after Trump won the Republican nomination, considerably more than that. On August 5, 2016, McDougal signed a limited life story rights agreement, granting AMI exclusive ownership of her account of any relationship she'd had with any then-married man. Her retainer with Davidson made explicit that the man in question was Donald Trump. In exchange, AMI agreed to pay her $150,000. The three men involved in the deal, Davidson, Crawford, and Gardena, took 45% of the payment as fees, leaving McDougal with a total of $82,500. The day she signed the contract, McDougal emailed Davidson to express confusion over what she was signing up for and how she'd have to respond to questions from reporters. "If you deny, you are safe," Davidson wrote. "We really do need to get this signed and wrapped up." "I'm the one who took it, so it's my fault too," McDougal told me. "But I didn't understand the full parameters of it." As voters went to the polls on Election Day in 2016, Howard and AMI's general counsel were on the phone with McDougal and a law firm representing her, promising to boost McDougal's career and offering to employ a publicist to help handle interviews. That publicist was Matthew Hiltzik, flack to Ivanka Trump, who had called me on Weinstein's behalf, although his services ultimately were not used. AMI responded quickly when journalists tried to interview McDougal. In May 2017, The New Yorker's Jeffrey Toobin, who was writing a profile of David Pecker, asked McDougal for comment about her relationships with AMI and Trump. Howard, working with a different publicist, forwarded McDougal a draft response with the subject line, "Send this." In August 2017, Pecker flew McDougal to New York and the two had lunch, during which he thanked her for her loyalty. In late 2017 and early 2018, as we worked on the story, AMI's interest in enforcing the contract seemed to increase. On January 30th, AMI's general counsel sent an email with the subject line, "McDougal contract extension, proposing a renewal and a new magazine cover to sweeten the deal." That February, our story ran anyway, with McDougal overcoming her fear and agreeing to speak on the record about the matter for the first time. In the years before, she had become religious and, in turn, fiercely altruistic. "Every girl who speaks is paving the way for another," she told me. Her own silence was about a consensual affair, but she could help expose a deeper and wider system of burying stories that was sometimes used to cover up more serious, even criminal, behavior. The White House called the story just more fake news. AMI's general counsel wrote that this report, too, was false and defamatory, and that I'd colluded in a plot by McDougal and her lawyer to milk AMI for more money. Howard issued his own threats to publicly attack The New Yorker. AMI insisted that it had declined to print McDougal's story because it did not find it credible. It just hadn't met the Inquirer's exacting journalistic standards. Chapter 51. Chupacabra. By the time we published, I'd already heard about another transaction that might show that McDougal's contract was part of a pattern of AMI working to suppress stories for Trump. Friends and colleagues of Dylan Howard contacted me to say that Howard had boasted that he had evidence that Trump may have fathered a child with his former housekeeper in the late 1980s. Howard would sometimes say things when drunk or high, including telling me they would pay for stories and not publish to protect people, one of the friends told me. "You don't forget when someone says, 'Oh, by the way, the maybe future president has a love child.'" In February 2018, I sat down in David Remnick's office and told him about the story. "You know what people are going to say when they find out you're reporting this," he said wonderingly. We both laughed. I knew my way around a paternity rumor. There was no evidence that the underlying rumor about the love child was true.
But that spring, a growing number of documents and sources made clear that AMI really had bought the rights to the dubious claim, then worked to prevent its disclosure. In late 2015, Dino Sajudin, a former Trump Tower doorman, had told AMI the story, along with the names of the supposed mother and child. For weeks, National Enquirer reporters pursued the matter. The tabloid retained two private investigators, Dano Hanks, who ran record searches on the family, and Michael Mancuso, a former criminal investigator, who administered a lie detector test to Sajudin. Several of the reporters doubted Sajudin's credibility. His ex-wife would later call him a fabulist. "He's seen the chupacabra," she said. "He's seen Bigfoot." But the former doorman passed the polygraph, testifying that high-level Trump employees, including Trump's head of security, Matthew Calamari, had told him the story. Then David Pecker abruptly ordered the reporters to stop. In November 2015, Sajudin signed an agreement to accept $30,000 for the exclusive rights to the information. Soon after, he met with an AMI reporter at a McDonald's in Pennsylvania and signed a further amendment, adding a $1 million penalty if the ex-doorman ever disclosed the information without AMI's permission. The reporter told Sajudin he'd get his money. Sajudin, seeming pleased, said it was going to be a very Merry Christmas. As he did later during the McDougal affair, Michael Cohen, Trump's personal attorney, had monitored the unfolding events closely. "There's no question it was done as a favor to continue to protect Trump," one former AMI employee told me. "That's black and white." Later, when journalists sought to report on the rumor, the Enquirer worked to thwart them. In the summer of 2017, two reporters at the Associated Press, Jeff Horwitz and Jake Pearson, had reported out and filed a detailed story. As they neared publication, Howard assembled a muscular legal team and threatened to sue the AP. In July, at AMI's urging, Sally Busby, AP's executive editor, and her general counsel met with Howard and his team. He'd hired Weinstein's representatives, the lawyers of Boies Schiller and Lanny Davis. The following month, Busby announced internally that the story wouldn't run after all. After robust internal discussion, AP News leaders determined that the story at the time did not meet AP's rigorous sourcing requirements, Busby later said, defending the decision. Several other AP journalists felt the sourcing was robust and expressed shock at the decision. Horwitz left work for days and had to be persuaded by his bosses to return. For almost a year after, the story stayed dead. But the next spring, that was changing. Enquirer sources were beginning to talk. By early March 2018, one was close to sharing a copy of the amendment Sajudin had signed in late 2015. The source and I met at a rundown Middle Eastern restaurant in Los Angeles, where I spent hours arguing the merits of sharing the document. That night, I headed back to Jonathan's place in West Hollywood with a printed copy in hand. "When did you realize?" Jonathan said theatrically when I walked in, late. I know, that I hate you," I said. We'd done this before. "We were gonna have dinner," he said. "Sorry, ran long." "You ran long yesterday," he said, and we proceeded to fight about this. I wondered how long we could keep going like this, with me absent and consumed and stressed out. Later, with Jonathan bundled off to bed, I stepped out to meet a delivery guy. Directly across the street, a pale, 30-something-year-old man with dark, stringy hair and stubble was standing next to a car, staring. I was beginning to experience that nagging, watched feeling again. Having dealt with a lifetime of my own curiosity from the press, I didn't want to be intrusive. But in order to respect the wishes of the people involved in the rumor, I had to find out if they wanted to say anything. In mid-March, I knocked on Sajudin's door in the woods in rural Pennsylvania. "I don't talk for free," he said, then slammed the door in my face. Emails and calls to the alleged love child, who was now, of course, no longer a child at all, got no response. Late that month, I searched California's Bay Area, trying recently listed addresses. I found only one family member who said, "I'm not supposed to talk to you." I tried a work address, too. The rumored love child was employed at, seriously, a genetic testing company. Finally,
I tried the family's home in Queens. It was small and faded, with clapboard siding. In a square of grass outside was a little shrine with a plaster Madonna. I stopped by a few times before encountering a middle-aged man I recognized as the husband of the woman who'd allegedly had the affair. He held his hands up as I approached.
"She's not gonna talk to you or nobody," he said.
He had a straight, uncomplicated inflection and a Latin American accent. He was convinced the rumor was untrue. The Inquirer's transaction had put the family in a difficult situation.
"I don't understand what they had to pay this guy for," he said. "I'm the dad."
"Got it," I said, and gave him a condoling look. I told him I was making sure they had the chance to respond if they wanted to. I said I understood how awful it could feel to have the press circling your family. He nodded.
"I understand. You're Farrell."
"Yeah."
"Oh, I know."
And then he was the one with the pitying look. By early April, we'd backed up the story with the accounts of 6 current and former AMI employees, texts and emails from the time at which AMI struck the deal, and the amendment Sajudin had signed at the McDonald's. As it had with McDougal, the White House denied the affair and added, "I'd refer you to AMI," which was one way to respond to a story documenting legally questionable collaboration with the company in question. Sean Lavery, the boyish Midwesterner assigned to fact-check the story, sent a detailed memo to Howard. Less than 30 minutes later, Radar Online, an AMI website, put out a post acknowledging everything. "Ronan Farrow from The New Yorker," it read, "is calling our staff and seems to think this is another example of how The Inquirer, by supposedly killing stories about President Trump, is a threat to national security." Minutes later, Howard was emailing. As he had with McDougal, he pled pure journalistic motivation and denied any collaboration with Trump.
"You're about to shit all over the institution that is The New Yorker," he wrote to Remnick. "Ronan's unhealthy obsession with our publication, and me, perhaps it's my smile, puts you at peril."
He added of me, "He's about to make for terrific Inquirer fodder." With Howard's confessional Radar Online post out in the wild, the AP raced to revive its efforts. The AP went live with its resurrected draft, and we published our story at The New Yorker overnight. Not all of AMI's efforts on Trump's behalf panned out. I'd later learn of one other case in which the company looked into a matter in close concert with Trump's associates. In early 2016, an anonymous woman, Katie Johnson in an initial legal document, Jane Doe in a subsequent one, filed a lawsuit against Trump. The plaintiff claimed that in 1994, when she was 13 years old and newly arrived in New York City to pursue modeling work, she'd been offered money to attend parties hosted by Jeffrey Epstein, the billionaire investor, and attended by Trump. Hair-curling allegations of sexual violence followed. The lawsuit contended that the plaintiff and other minors were forced to perform sex acts on Trump and Epstein, culminating in a savage sexual attack by Trump, that Trump had threatened the plaintiff and her family with physical harm should she ever speak, and that both Trump and Epstein were told that the girls involved were underage. There was truth in the general context. Epstein was close friends with Donald Trump.
"I've known Jeff for 15 years. Terrific guy,"
Trump told a reporter in 2002.
"He's a lot of fun to be with. It's even said he likes beautiful women as much as I do, and many of them are on the younger side. No doubt about it, Jeffrey enjoys his social life."
Miami Herald writer Julie K. Brown later published powerful reporting on widespread allegations that Epstein sexually abused minors. In 2019, federal agents arrested him on sex trafficking charges, unraveling a plea deal that had shielded the investor. The lenient agreement had been brokered by Alexander Acosta, a secretary of labor in Trump's cabinet, when he was a prosecutor. He later resigned over the matter. Soon after, Epstein was found dead in jail, hanged in an apparent suicide. But as had been the case with Sajudin's claims about the love child, the anonymous rape allegation wasn't backed by convincing evidence. The initial suit, filed in California, was dismissed on procedural grounds, refiled in New York, then dropped yet again. Norm Lubow, a former producer on The Jerry Springer Show and pusher of several dubious celebrity scandals, helped orchestrate the lawsuit and acted as the plaintiff's intermediary in the press. The plaintiff herself was difficult to reach. One attorney who represented her told me even he sometimes had trouble finding her. Few reporters ever made contact with her. One, Emily Sugarman, said that the woman's lawyer canceled a planned Skype or FaceTime interview several times, then replaced it with a brief phone call. Sugarman emerged as doubtful as most journalists about the story and the elusive woman at the heart of it. Possibly she was being threatened into retreat. Or possibly she was an invention of the checkered figures around her. But one additional curiosity was never made public. According to several AMI employees and one senior associate of Trump's, Pecker, who was at the time in close contact with Trump, learned of the lawsuit shortly after it was filed. After that, Howard was on the phone with Cohen, Trump's personal attorney, assuring him that they would track down the woman with the rape allegation and see what they could do about her. Dylan was on the phone with Cohen at all hours about it, one of the AMI employees recalled. It became a top priority. With Cohen monitoring the situation, Howard dispatched an AMI reporter to an address associated with one of the initial court filings. But the reporter found only a foreclosed home in the sleepy desert community of 29 Palms, California. A neighbor said that no one had been there since the previous fall. There was no opportunity to buy this story. Nevertheless, in the early days after the anonymous suit, when few media outlets were touching it, AMI ran several stories shooting down the claims in the lawsuit. One of the company's headlines on the suit quoted Trump calling it disgusting. Another went with bogus. In late 2016, the anonymous woman with the rape allegation resurfaced with new legal representation. Her new attorney was a professed defender of women, whom Howard would later describe as a longtime friend, Lisa Bloom. After he learned that Bloom was working on the case, Howard contacted the attorney to warn her away from it. Eventually, Bloom announced a last-minute cancellation of a planned press conference with the plaintiff and withdrew the suit for the final time. Other outlets were reporting stories that reinforced the idea of a pact between Trump and AMI, too. From early in the reporting on McDougal, I'd heard rumors that the porn actress Stormy Daniels had signed a non-disclosure agreement barring her from talking about a sexual encounter she claimed to have had with Trump. 2 months after I started talking to McDougal, the Wall Street Journal reported that Daniels had indeed signed such a contract, arranged directly through Michael Cohen. Not included in the journal's report was the fact that Daniels' lawyer, Keith Davidson, who had previously represented McDougal, had called Dylan Howard about the story first. Howard told Davidson that AMI was passing on the Daniels matter. Pecker had just extended himself for Trump and was growing antsy about the potential for fallout. But Howard directed Davidson to Michael Cohen, who established a shell company to pay Daniels $130,000 in exchange for her silence. The contract used pseudonyms. Daniels was Peggy Peterson, and Trump, David Dennison. "You know who's really been fucked?" Davidson later told me. "David Dennison, who was on my high school hockey team, and he is pissed." The stories AMI bought and buried during the election, like Sajudin's and McDougal's, along with the ones on which they engaged with Cohen more preliminarily, like those of Daniels and the anonymous accuser, raised thorny legal and political questions. Trump hadn't included any of the payments on his financial disclosure forms during the election. As we released our reporting, a nonprofit watchdog organization and a left-leaning political group filed formal complaints requesting that the Justice Department, the Office of Government Ethics, and the Federal Election Commission examine whether the payments to Daniels and McDougal violated federal election law. Legal experts said they might have. The timing, during the election, was good circumstantial evidence that AMI's intent had been to help the campaign. The conversations with Cohen, even more so. Media companies have various exemptions from campaign finance law. But that might not apply, the legal experts added, were it established that a media company was acting not in its press capacity, but as an extension of a powerful person's public relations effort. All of the AMI employees I spoke with said that the alliance with Trump had distorted the place and its business model. "We never printed a word about Trump without his approval," said Jerry George, the former AMI senior editor. Several of the employees told me that Pecker had reaped tangible benefits. They said that people close to Trump had introduced Pecker to potential sources of funding for AMI. In the summer of 2017, Pecker visited the Oval Office and dined at the White House with a French businessman known for brokering deals with Saudi Arabia. 2 months later, the businessman and Pecker met with the Saudi crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. Some of the employees felt that the most significant reward was AMI's steadily accumulating blackmail power over Trump. Howard bragged to friends that he was turning down television job offers because he felt his current position and his ability to hold negative stories over people gave him more power than any career in traditional journalism.
In theory, you would think that Trump has all the power in that relationship,
Maxine Page, the AMI veteran, told me.
But in fact, Pecker has the power. He has the power to run these stories. He knows where the bodies are buried.
The concern had run through the conversations with McDougal, too.
Someone in a high position that controls our country, if they can influence him, she said of Trump, it's a big deal.
The relationship between AMI and Trump was an extreme example of the media's potential to slip from independent oversight to cocktail party alliances with reporting subjects. But for AMI, it was also familiar territory. Over the years, the company had reached deals to shelve reporting around Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sylvester Stallone, Tiger Woods, Mark Wahlberg, and too many others to count.
We had stories and we bought them knowing full well they were never going to run, George said.
One after another, the AMI employees used the same phrase to describe this practice of purchasing a story in order to bury it. It was an old term in the tabloid industry. Catch and kill. Part 5. Severance. Chapter 52. Circle. Dylan Howard had a vindictive streak, 10 people who worked with him told me. Former employees would later tell the Associated Press that he openly described his sexual partners in the newsroom, discussed female employees' sex lives, and forced women to watch or listen to pornographic material. In 2012, in response to complaints from female colleagues, AMI launched an internal inquiry led by an outside consultant. The company maintained that the report found no serious wrongdoing. Its general counsel confirmed that women had lodged complaints about Howard, including one that he'd offered to create a Facebook page for a colleague's vagina. Maxine Page, the AMI veteran, said she complained on behalf of multiple other women. Liz Croken, another former reporter, said that after she told the outside consultant investigating the matter that Howard harassed her, she believed Howard retaliated against her, assigning her menial tasks and withholding substantive ones. Howard later denied all allegations of misconduct, and a spokesperson said the women were disgruntled. After my stories, several of Howard's colleagues said he appeared to be enraged. Two recalled him saying that he was going to get me. One warned him that this was silly, that the retaliation would be too transparent. Howard was undeterred. For a brief, shining moment, I was an all-caps, sans-serif, recurring villain in the pages of the National Enquirer. A few days after the doorman story broke, a first comment request arrived about the uncle I couldn't remember having met, whom Weinstein had brought up in his legal threat letters. The National Enquirer intends to publish a story reporting Ronan Farrow's uncle, John Charles Villiers Farrow, was convicted of sexually abusing 2 10-year-old boys. Shortly after that, intermediaries began sending messages aggressively soliciting dick pics. When I failed to send any, the Enquirer published a complaint that I'd refused. When I responded with anything that seemed flirtatious or frank, Howard ran that, too. Howard and his colleagues reached out for comment about fabricated yarns, including one implicating me and another journalist, who'd worked on a prominent story critical of AMI, in some sort of Brazilian sex romp. If only my life were so exciting. Howard and his associates were calling, emailing. These moves were rote formula. And on the recipient's side, too, there was a playbook. Respond, curry favor with Howard, trade an item. The other journalist Howard targeted was engaging the Enquirer through a well-connected lawyer who could have a quiet conversation, broker an agreement, ensure that AMI kept the journalist's name out. But the other journalist wasn't working on ongoing reporting on the subject. I was. Acquiescing to threats from a hostile subject of reporting was exactly the response that had nearly killed the Weinstein story the year before. I did nothing and kept reporting. These machinations had been the least elaborate of Howard's efforts. He had also, several AMI employees said, deployed a subcontractor associated with Coleman Rayner, the same infrastructure used to create secret recordings for Weinstein, to surveil Jonathan in Los Angeles. His home had been watched, his movements followed. Howard would come in and be like, "We're going to put a tail on Ronan's boyfriend," one of the employees recalled, and later, "I've got someone following him. We're going to find out where he's going." Howard said the employees' assertions were false. In the end, the employees said, Jonathan's routine had been so boring, the subcontractor surveilling him had given up.
"I'm interesting," Jonathan said when I told him. "I am a very interesting person. I went to an escape room."
By then, the walls were closing in on AMI. Several outlets, especially the Wall Street Journal, were still digging into the company's transactions on Trump's behalf during the election, and the revelations were spinning up law enforcement. In April 2018, FBI agents raided Cohen's hotel and office, looking for records related to the payment to McDougal and correspondence between Cohen, Pecker, and Howard. Law enforcement bore down on Pecker and Howard. In response to my articles, they had denied everything, called the notion of catch and kill ridiculous, claimed to have had only journalistic intentions. Just a few months later, they cut a deal to avoid prosecution for a battery of potential crimes, including violations of campaign finance law, and admitted to everything. In the early days of Trump's candidacy, they conceded, Pecker had met with Cohen and another member of the campaign. Pecker offered to help deal with negative stories about that presidential candidate's relationships with women by, among other things, assisting the campaign in identifying such stories so they could be purchased and their publication avoided, the non-prosecution agreement read. They'd caught and they'd killed, and the intention had been to swing a presidential election. As part of its agreement with prosecutors, AMI promised to commit no crimes whatsoever for 3 years. Within the year, the Inquirer was facing questions as to whether it had breached that clause. Howard threw the full weight of the publication into chasing a story about Jeff Bezos, the founder and CEO of Amazon, cheating on his wife. This time, Howard secured the dirty pictures he habitually sought. Aside from Bezos' wife and mistress, Dylan Howard appeared to have more interest in the man's penis than any other person on the planet. The familiar routine played out. AMI threatened to publish and pressed Bezos to cut a deal. Bezos went on the offensive. "No thank you, Mr. Pecker," he wrote in an open letter. "Rather than capitulate to extortion and blackmail, I've decided to publish exactly what they sent me, despite the personal cost and embarrassment they threaten." In early 2019, with federal prosecutors circling whether Howard had breached the non-prosecution agreement and AMI swimming in debt, the Inquirer and its sister outlets, The Globe and The National Examiner, were sold for scrap. The purchaser, James Cohen, whose father founded the Hudson News franchise, was mostly known as a collector of art and for throwing his daughter a $1 million bat mitzvah. Questions swirled as to whether Cohen was really financing the agreement himself or there were others doing so behind the scenes. The New York Post, practically exploding with schadenfreude, quoted a source familiar with AMI as saying, "It looks like the whole thing could be a big circle." The walls were closing in on Howard's ally, Harvey Weinstein, too. In the months after the New York Times and the New Yorker stories broke, dozens of additional women accused Weinstein of sexual harassment or violence. The number grew to 30, then 60, then 80. Some, including Canosa, filed lawsuits. Law enforcement in London, Los Angeles, and New York circled. The day after the first New Yorker story broke, Sergeant Kerry Thompson, a detective from the NYPD Cold Case Squad, who had overseen the sting operation in the Gutierrez case years earlier, began traveling up and down the eastern seaboard to find Lucia Evans, who'd told me that Weinstein sexually assaulted her in his office in 2004. When the detectives found Evans, they told her that if she filed a complaint, it could help put Weinstein behind bars. Evans wanted to help, but she was scared. She realized, and the detectives conceded, that playing a role in criminal proceedings would be a bruising process. Weinstein's lawyers would play dirty. They'd throw everything they could at her.
I think everyone's self-preservation mechanism kicks in when they make a big life decision such as this, she said. What is it going to mean to you? How is it going to affect your life, your family, your friends?
After months of sleepless nights, she decided to proceed with the complaint against Weinstein. Early on the morning of May 25th, 2018, a black SUV slid up to the entrance of the NYPD's first precinct. As cameras flashed, Thompson and another detective, Nick DeGaudio, met Harvey Weinstein at the SUV and led him into the precinct. For the occasion of his surrender, Weinstein had been styled as a mild-mannered professor in a black blazer and a powder-blue V-neck sweater. Under one arm, he carried a stack of books about Hollywood and Broadway. Weinstein disappeared into the building to be booked on charges of rape and a criminal sex act. When he was led out afterward, the books were gone, the hands in cuffs. Weinstein was accompanied by his latest attorney, Benjamin Braffman, and a private detective named Herman Weisberg. Weisberg was a former NYPD detective himself, and his firm, Sage Intelligence and Security, flaunted that expertise much as the Israelis did their former Mossad status. He'd been on the Weinstein team for a while. The previous fall, before my story broke, he'd been on the McGowan beat, arriving at one meeting with Weinstein to announce that he'd uncovered a not-yet-public police inquiry into whether she'd been caught carrying drugs.
"Can we leak that?"
Weinstein had said, excited. Former colleagues called Weisberg a bloodhound. He specialized in ferreting out and interrogating witnesses. For all the symbolism of the perp walk, Weinstein posted $1 million bail that day and went home. Ankle braceleted, he was permitted to move between his homes in New York and Connecticut. In the ensuing months, the NYPD case expanded from 2 women to 3, adding a charge of predatory sexual assault from Mimi Halle, a former production assistant who claimed Weinstein sexually assaulted her at his apartment in 2006. But Weinstein's offensive expanded, too, its tendrils encircling those who agreed to participate in the case and those who worked on it. In the press and to prosecutors, Braffman raged that Weinstein had friendly messages from Halle, including one seeking a meeting after the alleged assault. And, after Weisberg's labors, fruitful grounds emerged for discrediting DeGaudio, the detective. A peripheral witness in Lucia Evans's case claimed she'd given DeGaudio new details that he then withheld from prosecutors. DeGaudio denied it, but it was all the ammunition Braffman needed. He expressed public outrage and accused law enforcement of a conspiracy against Weinstein. DeGaudio was removed from the case. Lucia Evans's count against Weinstein was dropped. "Two things can be true," a source in the district attorney's office told me. "You can believe a survivor, but consent to dismissal of her count because maintaining it would result in a weakening of the other counts because of things that happened in the process." Braffman attributed the move to bravura private espionage. "Whatever success I may have in the Weinstein case, Herman has played a substantial part in those accomplishments," Braffman said, explaining that Weisberg had helped uncover materials about several of the important prosecution witnesses. Soon, the myriad lawsuits were looking like they might resolve cleanly for Weinstein, too. A few months after Evans's count was dropped, reports began to circulate that Weinstein and the Weinstein Company's former board were considering a $44 million blanket settlement to resolve the civil claims. Much remained arrayed against Weinstein. Several remaining criminal counts in New York awaited trial. Authorities in Los Angeles and London continued to build cases. Several women with civil claims looked askance at the prospect of a breezy blanket settlement and publicly pledged to keep going with their lawsuits. As Weinstein prepared for the criminal trial, a small item about him ran in page 6. In a photo, he leaned over the counter at Cipriani Dolci on the mezzanine level of Grand Central. His pink neck bulged out of a loose-fitting black tee. Several inches of boxers showed over sagging jeans. He looked thinner, older, more hunched than before. The item was about the group of dark-suited men huddled around Weinstein, heads bowed in focused conversation. The copy said that one was a private investigator, another a lawyer. However far he had fallen, there was Harvey Weinstein with his mercenaries, plotting, planning, and bracing for fights to come. For Weinstein and others like him, the army of spies was alive and well. Chapter 53. Axiom. It was after the Love Child story and summer again when I stumbled into the first clues about Black Cube's activities following the Weinstein job. I'd just slipped into a hot, airless subway car when the call came in. The caller ID read, Axiom. A moment later, I got a text.
I am trying to reach you directly and privately. It's regarding a fry pan that's scratch-resistant. Sometimes I cook, and the black coating scares me.
I'd recently posted a social media picture of a frying pan marketed under the label Black Cube. Scratch-resistant, may use false identities and shell companies to extract information, I'd written.
Ha ha ha,
Umbra Gutierrez commented dryly. As the subway car slipped into a tunnel, I wrote back, Can you say more about who you are?
I can say I do surveillance.
And later, resisting my entreaties for more information,
We will need to meet discreetly and make sure we are not followed.
A few days later, I was threading my way through the perspiring crowds of the theater district. I'd suggested we meet at the Brazilian restaurant where I got the recording from Gutierrez. I arrived on time, asked for a table for two, sat down. The phone rang with an encrypted signal call. Axiom appeared on the screen again.
Don't order, said a man's voice.
I looked around again. No one I could see.
You're wearing the messenger bag, light blue shirt, and slightly darker jeans, he continued.
He told me to leave and walk slowly.
Walk against traffic, please.
I craned my neck around.
Don't look around, he continued, a little annoyed. I'll be about a half a block away, so please stop for 1 and 1.5 minutes at the intersections. I'm going to make sure no same people show up there from here.
As he took me on a circuitous route through Hell's Kitchen, I tried to check again.
Don't look, just walk naturally, against traffic. It's good, keep going.
He told me to stop at a basement Peruvian restaurant that lacked cell reception.
Ask for a table in the back, all the way in the back.
I did as he said. 10 minutes later, a man sat down in front of me. His hair was dark and curly, and he was a little soft around the middle. He had a thick Ukrainian accent.
I am a concerned party, said Igor Ostrovsky.
He slid a phone across the table, motioned for me to swipe through the pictures on it. There was my block, my front door, my superintendent outside. And there was the Nissan, with two men inside. Ostrovsky, dark and chubby, and Haken, pale and bald, with a fierce glare. Ostrovsky said that they were with a local private investigation firm licensed in New York.
But the work product, the final reports, Black Cube was putting their name on it.
Why are you doing this? I asked. While much of the work the subcontractors did was routine, tracking cheating spouses or digging for dirt in custody cases that
might not be ethical, but it's legitimate,
their work for Black Cube was something else. Ostrovsky told me about their efforts to track me, in person and through my phone. I thought back to the spam texts, the weather updates, and then the blitz of political surveys I got at the World Trade Center. He didn't know if either was connected, but did say he'd gotten accurate information about my location at roughly the same time that I'd received the survey texts.
I fear, Ostrovsky told me, that it may be illegal.
He took issue with the tactics used against me. And it wasn't just me. The subcontractors were still following people for Black Cube. Ostrovsky wanted to know why. He read me a list of target names and the dates and times of the operations surveilling them. At one upscale hotel restaurant after another, the subcontractors had monitored meetings between Black Cube agents and marks who appeared to be experts in technology and cybercrime. Several had expertise in aggressive new solutions for hacking and monitoring cell phones, like the Pegasus software made by the Israeli cyber intelligence firm NSO Group, which Sleeper had worried about. Ostrovsky said that the limited information he possessed was
designed to be traceable back to me.
He was anxious that he was being surveilled. He'd even swept the area surrounding the restaurant before entering. I was also becoming watchful. I'd asked a colleague to follow a few blocks behind, then keep an eye on the restaurant. Eunjin Lee, a slight Korean-American woman who just cleared 5 feet, wasn't much for Krav Maga, but she'd spot any tails. Ostrovsky and I left separately, 10 minutes apart. When I got a safe distance away, Lee called. A man had appeared to follow the two of us, lagging behind as we entered, and lingering by the entrance for more than an hour. Nothing is certain, it turns out, except death and taxes and investigation by the Southern District of New York. Federal prosecutors there had begun to circle Black Cube after my story about the spy agency in late 2017, launching an investigation out of their Complex Frauds and Cybercrime Unit. It didn't take long before the prosecutors, who were looking at Harvey Weinstein and AMI, too, were hoping to meet with me, not as a reporter, but as a witness. The calls and messages from the Southern District started coming in the days following the McDougal story in February 2018 and didn't let up in the months that followed. The inquiries came from the Southern District prosecutors themselves and from intermediaries, including Preet Bharara, the former U.S. attorney there. They came to me and to Bertoni, the New Yorker's lawyer. A law school classmate working in law enforcement had been sending messages too, asking to catch up. Not long after Ostrovsky and I first met, I made my way through the heat to dinner at a small restaurant near the World Trade Center. I was sitting at the bar, sweaty and dowdily suited, when his voice sounded. "Hi there." I looked up from my phone. A row of perfect teeth flashed. He was symmetrical to a catalog model standard. Even his name was an actor name, a pretend name, the name of the most trustworthy doctor in a 1950s suburb. He slid closer, another blinding smile. "Been a long time." Me, feeling schlubby. "I've been busy. Can't imagine with what." He ordered us drinks, then we settled into a booth. It was a lovely dinner with much, "How is so-and-so?" I'd forgotten how much I'd withdrawn from my own life. Were it not for the aggressive surveillance efforts, I'd have no social life at all. He'd married, he said. "How's that?" He shrugged. "Complicated. You?" "Good. He's great." A beat of silence. I thought about the long, tense year with Jonathan. "But also complicated?" he asked. "Well, long distance is hard." He looked at me sympathetically. "You're under a lot of pressure." "It's not so bad now, and you must be too." He leaned in, the warmest smile yet, no longer appropriate for catalogs even. "It doesn't have to be like this, you know," he said. I could feel his breath across the narrow table. "Dealing with all of this, by yourself?" He was adjusting a knife in front of him a little, running a finger up its silvered length. "Are you talking about..." "You should come in." "Oh." "Be a witness. You won't have to reveal any sources you don't want to." I withdrew, sitting up straight. "You know you can't guarantee that." "So?" he said. "If you're a victim, you should talk." The personal interest seemed benign and separate from the professional entreaties, but the two dynamics jostled uncomfortably. As we stepped out into the night and said our goodbyes, he lingered for a moment during a parting hug. "Call me," he said, "if you change your mind about any of it." Then he was flashing the Crestad smile over his shoulder, walking off into the night. Bertoni and I turned over the dilemma. Working with law enforcement was a fraught decision for any journalistic outlet. There were obvious scenarios in which journalists should go to the cops, including any tip-off about impending physical harm to someone. But there were no easy calls in this case. It wasn't inconceivable that I'd been a victim of a crime, flowing from the phone tracking or the deceptions designed to elicit reporting material from me. But I wasn't confident that there was enough danger to myself or others to merit sitting with prosecutors and answering questions that might quickly turn to sources and reporting I'd pledged to keep secret. Protecting those sources, including Ostrovsky, had to be my priority. And it wasn't just about me. Bertoni feared that any one conversation with law enforcement would set a dangerous precedent for The New Yorker. Would we as easily be able to decline inquiries about, say, a government whistleblower, once we'd already said yes on this story? Chapter 54. Pegasus. At first, Ostrovsky wouldn't give me the name of his boss, but there were more than enough clues. In one of the images he'd shown me, the Nissan's license plates were even visible. I typed in the name I'd come up with and pulled up a promotional video. "I'm the guy out in the field, the action taker," a bald man with a Russian accent said in the video. "My name is Roman Hyken, and I'm the founder of Infotactic Group." A jaunty techno beat played. Over footage of buttonhole cameras, title cards promised the best high-tech surveillance equipment. Hyken, doing his best impression of James Bond or Ethan Hunt, darted athletically through crowds. It was beguilingly cheesy. Infotactic was small time, just a handful of freelancers, most of them with day jobs. Still, Haken, over the course of that past year working for Black Cube, had sought to push the envelope, from the phone tracking to the boasts about his ability to illicitly obtain financial records. In the video, Haken was deadly serious about his skills.
"When I was young and first learned how to read," he said, "I would fascinate my parents with my ability to memorize the text of my favorite book, Sherlock Holmes."
Ostrovsky kept passing along his insights about Infotactic's ongoing operations for Black Cube. "Sometimes I'd go to the appointed location or send colleagues who were less likely to be spotted to keep watch from afar. The pattern was always the same. Undercover Black Cube agents meeting with cybercrime and technology experts in luxe hotels. Ostrovsky and I would meet too, at hole-in-the-wall restaurants we'd immediately depart in favor of jumpy conversations conducted while walking mazy routes through side streets. Once, we sat in a dim corner of a hotel lobby and spoke for a half an hour before he abruptly excused himself, then came back worried, saying we had to move fast. He suspected two men sitting nearby were following us. They looked like professionals. They'd been watching too closely. We took a cab, then another cab. He had one taxi stop on the West Side Highway, pull over to the shoulder, and wait for any tails to go by or be exposed for slowing. A year before, I'd have thought the paranoia excessive. Through the remainder of 2018, I continued my reporting on the world of Israeli private intelligence, keeping at Black Cube in the process. Ido Minkowski, the genial freelancer who handled the spy agency's public relations, was a regular contact.
"Ronan, baby," he'd say when I called. "Don't divorce me,"
he'd write, responding evasively to my latest reporting inquiry. In January 2019, he agreed to have a drink during one of his regular stops in New York. Several hours before that meeting, Ostrovsky called. Black Cube had ordered Roman Haken and Infotactic to find a pen capable of secretly recording audio. Ostrovsky sent a picture of the spy pen they'd found. It was piano black with a silver clip. Nothing you'd notice if you weren't looking for it, but it had features you could track, like a little ring of chrome at a specific height on its barrel. Minkowski and I agreed to meet at a wine bar in Hell's Kitchen. I arrived to find him lounging in a corner with a Cheshire Cat grin. Minkowski ordered a cocktail, led with his usual flattery offensive. Then he announced that he was going to take notes on my reporting questions. He produced, from his jacket pocket, a black pen with a silver clip. "Funny, I have the same one," I said. His grin faltered.
"It's a special pen," he said, "from Minkowski Industries."
I asked Minkowski if he was recording. He looked injured. He informed Zarella, the Black Cube founder, of any meetings, of course. He had to. He was polygraphed periodically. But,
"Ronan, I would never, ever record."
Later, Minkowski would maintain that the pen he'd taken out was perfectly innocent and that he wasn't aware of any other. But on the way out of the meeting that night, I texted Ostrovsky, "Do you know who that pen was delivered to?" And he replied with a string of pictures, all showing Minkowski, just before we met, standing on a corner, accepting delivery of the spy pen. A few days later, the spy pen appeared to resurface in Black Cube's latest operation. A middle-aged man with a neat white beard, who identified himself as Michel Lambert, sat down for lunch with John Scott Railton, a researcher for the watchdog group Citizen Lab. Lambert said he worked for the Paris-based agricultural technology firm CPW Consulting and asked to meet about Scott Railton's doctoral research on using kite-mounted cameras to create maps, which is a thing, apparently. But as food arrived, Lambert's interests strayed. Citizen Lab, which tracks state-backed efforts to hack and surveil journalists, had recently reported that NSO Group's Pegasus software compromised an iPhone belonging to a friend of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi, not long before Saudi operatives cut Khashoggi to pieces with a bone saw. The investigation had prompted sharp criticism of NSO Group, which denied that its software was used to target Khashoggi, but also refused to answer questions about whether the software had been sold to the Saudi government. Lambert wanted to know about Citizen Lab's work on NSO Group. He asked whether there was any racist element to the focus on an Israeli group. He pressed Scott Railton about his views on the Holocaust. As they spoke, Lambert took out a black pen with a silver clip and a chrome ring on its barrel. He laid it just so on a legal pad in front of him, tip pointed at Scott Railton. The script was familiar. In the operations in which Stella Pen Pechenech had been involved, targeting employees of Westface Capital and critics of AmTrust Financial Services, Black Cube agents had also solicited anti-Semitic statements. But this time, the mark was wise to it. Suspecting subterfuge, Scott Railton had decked himself out with recording devices. He'd been taping the whole time. It was a spy versus spy confrontation of sorts, and each had brought his own tale as backup. Raphael Satter, an Associated Press journalist with whom Scott Railton had been working, arrived with a camera and started questioning the man who was not named Michel Lambert after all. The Black Cube agent's cover had been blown. From a table nearby, Ostrovsky had been watching and photographing the meeting too. Haken, who had been there earlier and then departed, started calling, apoplectic.
"Our guy got burned," he said. "Get to the lobby immediately. He needs to get out."
The Black Cube agent ducked out of a service entrance. Ostrovsky picked up the agent and his luggage, then drove around, trying to shake potential tails. As they drove, the agent placed frantic calls, trying to book the first possible flight out of New York. On his luggage was a tag bearing the name Almog and a home address in Israel. This name was real. The agent was Aaron Almog Asulin, a retired Israeli security official later reported to have been involved in a string of Black Cube operations. Black Cube and NSO Group would later deny any connection to the operation against Citizen Lab. But in many of the meetings Ostrovsky had described to me over the preceding months, Almog Asulin had been there, appearing to target figures who criticized NSO Group and argued that its software was being used to hunt journalists. Black Cube was furious about the botched operation. The agency ordered that everyone with knowledge of the matter be polygraphed immediately. Ostrovsky called, worried that it was only a matter of time before he was exposed. He wanted to talk, and not just to a reporter. He had knowledge of espionage operations by agents closely linked to a foreign government on American soil. He had already tried the FBI, only to be passed between skeptical agents who finally hung up. He asked if I had a better contact in law enforcement. I called Bertoni. He was still adamant about keeping direct engagement with prosecutors to a minimum, but he agreed that there was nothing wrong with informing a source about how to get to the authorities. The last time I discussed the matter with my old classmate was at another restaurant in the financial district. I stepped messily out of a downpour. He, neatly dry, flashed another perfect smile and ordered drinks. "You should think about it," he said again. On the table, his hand was a hair's breadth from mine. "You don't have to deal with all this alone." I turned over how it would feel. Then I withdrew my hand by a few inches. I said I wouldn't talk, but I had sources who might. I asked for the right contact to give them. Soon after, I sent Ostrovsky a name at the Southern District of New York. Ostrovsky got a lawyer, John Tai, the same whistleblower attorney I consulted, and began the process of volunteering to be a witness. Chapter 55. Melting. At NBC News, the year after the Weinstein story was fraught. In late November 2017, Savannah Guthrie, wearing a floral print black dress fit for a morning TV funeral, announced that Matt Lauer had been fired overnight. A detailed complaint from a colleague about inappropriate sexual behavior in the workplace had come in less than 48 hours before. She said she was heartbroken, calling Lauer my dear, dear friend, and emphasizing that he was loved by many, many people here. Guthrie read a statement from Andy Lack that suggested management was shocked about Lauer, too. The unnamed colleague had lodged the first complaint about his behavior in the over 20 years he's been at NBC News. The network moved quickly to reinforce that idea in the wider press. After the announcement, Oppenheim gathered members of the investigative unit in the conference room on the fourth floor. He said that while the behavior alleged by the unnamed colleague was unacceptable, the breach was of professional, not criminal, standards of conduct. Some of the behavior took place in the workplace, and Matt Lauer is Matt Lauer, he said, so there's obviously a power differential there. But, Oppenheim emphasized, the network employees who spoke with the unnamed colleague did not report her using words like criminal or assault. Soon, articles to which NBC's communications team contributed were conveying the same message. When the network collaborated with People magazine on a cover story announcing Hoda Kotb as Lauer's replacement, "Hoda and Savannah, our hearts were broken," read the headline. This party line would become more explicit. Multiple sources described the cause for termination as an affair that violated NBC's terms of employment, that article read. Sources initially told the Post that Lauer had been accused of sexual assault, Page Six reported, but later said it was inappropriate sexual behavior. Outlets in contact with NBC at the time said the network made no attempt to alter the characterizations of the matter as an affair. Oppenheim also echoed Lack's suggestion that the network had been unaware of any complaints about Lauer until 2 days before, when the unnamed colleague came forward. The statement struck several journalists present as strange. Variety and the New York Times had both been working on articles accusing Lauer of serial sexual misconduct for weeks, calling numerous people at the network in the process. And many in the building had heard of complaints about Lauer long before that. At the meeting with Oppenheim, McHugh spoke up again. "Prior to Monday, a lot of us have heard rumors of stuff about Matt. Let's just say that. Prior to Monday, was NBC aware of any allegations of sexual misconduct against Matt?" "No," Oppenheim said. "We went back and looked, and as we said in the statement, there has not been an allegation made internally in 20 years, in any place where there would be a record of such a thing." The qualifying language was significant. That there would be no formal HR records about a figure of Lauer's importance was practically an assumption. Weinstein had also been adamant that there were no formal records of sexual misconduct allegations in his file either. So had Bill O'Reilly at Fox News. But that wasn't the question. McHugh hadn't asked about formal records. He'd asked whether NBC had been aware. And on this, Oppenheim was less clear. "We all read the New York Post and walk past supermarket checkout stands and see the National Enquirer," he said. "There's not a lot you can do with that, especially when the parties involved are saying this is National Enquirer nonsense." Oppenheim was right. Lauer, AMI's employees and internal records would later reveal, had been of great interest to the Enquirer all through 2017 and 2018. One email exchange within the tabloid even contained the resume of the anonymous colleague whose accusations precipitated the firing. Not long after, Greenberg called McHugh into his office for what McHugh suspected was an effort to determine whether he was talking to the press. McHugh said that he was disquieted by what he was learning about NBC's in-house problems and the bearing they might have had on our Weinstein coverage. "That's what people are talking about. They're all saying that they were covering up for Matt Lauer," Greenberg said. "Yeah," McHugh replied. "You really think they were aware of a problem with Matt Lauer?" Greenberg said. McHugh looked him in the eye and said, "I do." Over the following months, the message that no one at NBC knew about Lauer became a steady drumbeat. In May 2018, NBC Universal announced the final results of an internal investigation. "We found no evidence indicating that any NBC News or Today Show leadership, news HR, or others in positions of authority in the news division received any complaints about Lauer's workplace behavior prior to November 27, 2017, the self-report concluded. The network had resisted calls for an independent investigation, both within the company and in the press. Outside lawyers were enlisted to review the results after the fact, but the research was conducted entirely by Kim Harris's team, including Stephanie Franco, the company's senior vice president for employment law. The day the internal report was announced, Oppenheim and Harris called another crisis meeting with the investigative unit. The assembled journalists erupted with skeptical questions. McHugh was again among them. "Has NBC ever paid an employee who presented information on Matt to sign a non-disclosure agreement?" he asked. Harris blinked.
she said.
No.
Then he asked if there had been any settlements in the last 6 or 7 years with any employees related to harassment in general. More hesitation.
Not that I'm aware of, Harris said, finally.
At one point in the meeting, Harris appeared to grow impatient with the journalist's calls for an independent review.
It feels like having an outside voice, whether they came to the same conclusions or not, would make it go away quicker,
said one woman in the room.
It's so frustrating.
Well, if the press would stop covering it, it will go away, Harris said.
There was a pause, then still another investigative journalist said,
But we are the press.
From the beginning, other outlets were publishing reporting at odds with Oppenheim's and Harris's characterizations of what the network knew. Hours after NBC announced Lauer's termination, Variety asserted that several women complained to executives at the network about Lauer's behavior, which fell on deaf ears given the lucrative advertising surrounding Today. The publication suggested that the complaints about Lauer were an open secret. He had given one colleague a sex toy with an explicit note about how he hoped to use it on her. He'd played fuck, marry, kill games on open mics during commercial breaks. Clips of a similar tenor began to surface, including one of Lauer in 2006 seeming to tell Meredith Vieira, keep bending over like that, it's a nice view. At a 2008 private Friars Club roast of Lauer, Katie Couric had performed a David Letterman-style top 10 list that included a reference to a sex act between Lauer and Ann Curry, and Jeff Zucker, then the head of NBC Universal, did a bit about Lauer's wife forcing him to sleep on the couch because of his indiscretions. Donald Trump, then the host of The Celebrity Apprentice, had attended.
The whole theme was that he does the show and then he has sex with people, with employees,
Joe Scarborough said on air.
So was this whispered behind closed doors? No, it was shouted from the mountaintops, and everybody laughed about it.
Several junior Today employees said Lauer had been brazen in pursuing sexual encounters with them in the office. Addie Collins, a former production assistant, told me that Lauer had aggressively, almost obsessively, hit on her in 2000 when she was 24 years old. She'd kept many of the notes he'd sent her over work email or in the software used to maintain show rundowns.
Now you're killing me. You look great today. A bit tough to concentrate, read a typical one.
Because of Lauer's power in their workplace, Collins told me she found it difficult to decline when he started ordering her to his dressing room, or even, on one occasion, to a bathroom stall, for sexual favors. She'd consented, but it had made her feel sick, afraid for her job, afraid of retaliation. Though she couldn't prove it, she suspected Lauer later contributed to her missing out on professional opportunities. Some of the women claimed their office encounters with Lauer had not been consensual. One former NBC employee told the New York Times that, in 2001, Lauer summoned her to his office, then pressed the button on his desk that, like those in many executive offices at 30 Rock, remotely shut his door. She said she'd felt helpless as he'd pulled down her pants, bent her over a chair, and had sex with her. She passed out. Lauer's assistant took her to a nurse. Over the course of 2018, I'd learn of 7 claims of sexual misconduct raised by women who worked with Lauer. Most of the women could point to documents or other people they'd told to back up their accounts. Several said they had told colleagues and believed the network knew about the problem. I was also beginning to learn of a pattern surrounding women with complaints. In the years after 2011 or 2012, the same time frame in which Harris claimed NBC hadn't settled with any employees over harassment issues, the network in fact brokered non-disclosure agreements with at least 7 women who experienced alleged harassment or discrimination within the company. The agreements also required the women to waive their right to bring suit. In most cases, the women received substantial payouts that parties involved in the transaction said were disproportionate to any conventional compensation for departing the company. When Harris said she was unaware of any harassment settlements, she appeared to be capitalizing on a technicality. Many of the payouts were what the network referred to as enhanced severance, offered to the women as they left their jobs. But individuals involved, including on the company's side, disputed that characterization,
saying the agreements were designed to restrain women with allegations from speaking. Several of the women who signed the non-disclosure agreements had complaints that were unrelated to Lauer about other men in leadership positions within NBC News. Two settlements, reached in the first few years of the period Harris described, were with women who experienced alleged harassment from two senior executives who subsequently left the company. Everyone knew why they were let go internally, said one member of NBC's leadership who was closely involved in the departure of both men. NBC also brokered the 2017 agreement with the woman who accused Corvo, the Dateline producer who oversaw the review of the Weinstein story, of sexually harassing her. But other pacts called into question the network's claim that it had known nothing about the women's allegations against Lauer. One on-air personality, who signed a non-disclosure agreement in 2012, said that NBC sought the deal after she showed colleagues messages that she took to be propositions from both Lauer and one of the senior executives who later departed the company. Colleagues recalled both men making lewd remarks about the on-air personality over open mics during broadcasts. "I was like a hanging piece of meat," she said. "I would walk into work with a knot in my stomach. I would come home and cry." After she declined the advances, she felt she received fewer assignments. "I got punished," she said. "My career took a sharp nosedive." She decided not to make a formal report because she doubted the efficacy of the company's HR department and feared further harm to her career. She did, however, begin to tell colleagues and to plan her departure from the company. When NBC proposed the agreement as she departed, she recalled her agent saying, "I've never seen this before in my life. They want you to sign an NDA," adding, "You must have something huge on them." The agent told me that he recalled the exchange too. The contract, which I later reviewed, waived the on-air personality's right to sue. It barred her from making negative statements about NBC Universal, except as may be required for bona fide news reporting. It was on NBC News letterhead, signed by her and the executive she said harassed her. Another settlement with a woman who disclosed a serious allegation about Lauer within the company was reached in 2013. A few months after the Lauer story broke, I took a seat next to Ann Curry, his former co-anchor, at an Italian restaurant in Greenwich Village. She sat on a bar stool next to me, face graven with concern. She told me that complaints about Lauer verbally harassing women in the office were well known in her day, and that once, in 2010, a colleague had pulled her into an empty office and broken down, saying Lauer had exposed himself and propositioned her. "It was as close as you could get to a woman just melting in front of you in pain," Curry said. Later, I'd learn the woman's identity. Melissa Lawner, the Today producer who'd met with me after she left to work in radio. As Lawner told the story to colleagues, she and Lauer had been at a work event at 30 Rock the evening before she broke down in front of Curry. Lauer had asked her to leave the event to see him in his office, which she took to be a professional inquiry. When they arrived, he closed the door behind them. She recalled standing expectantly and telling Lauer, "I thought you had to chat." Lauer told her to sit on his couch and began to make small talk. He joked about how much he disliked work cocktail parties like the one they'd just attended. Then, she told the colleagues, he unzipped his pants and exposed his erect penis. Lawner was separated from her husband, but still married. Born in the slums of Bangkok, she'd worked hard to reach her professional role at the time. She remembered reeling in response to Lauer's advance, laughing nervously, trying to extricate herself by cracking a joke about not wanting to be intimate in an office where everyone else has done it. Lawner recalled Lauer saying that he knew she wanted it, and in response to the joke about his office dalliances, that he figured she liked it dirty, and that the encounter would be a first for you. Then, by her account, he became angry, saying, "Melissa, you're a fucking tease. This is not good. You led me on." Sources close to Lauer told me he disputed her account of events, saying that he recalled making a joking, lewd gesture, but not exposing himself or propositioning her. But Lawner, visibly distraught, began recounting her claim in detail the next day, and told it consistently in the years after. She begged Curry and another on-air personality not to report her name, saying she knew Lauer would destroy her career. But Curry did tell two senior executives at the company that they needed to do something about Lauer.
I told them that they had a problem in him, that he had a problem with women, that they had to keep an eye on him.
And then, as far as Curry ever heard, nothing happened. Lawner told the colleagues that she was miserable afterward. Lauer didn't talk to her for weeks. Afraid that she'd be fired, she began looking for other jobs. But when she got an offer at CNN, something strange happened. Several NBC News executives called her into their offices for meetings and delivered the same message. Each said that Lauer had insisted that she stay.
"I don't know what's going on between you and him," one told her, "but I need to keep him happy."
She stayed at the network. Several years later, as her contract was about to end, she was fired anyway. She told the colleagues that she was never given a reason why. A lawyer she consulted noted that the delayed departure prevented her from raising harassment claims due to their statutes of limitations. As Lawner left NBC News, her agent called to report something unusual. In addition to standard non-disclosure and non-disparagement clauses, the network was offering her a six-figure sum in exchange for signing a release of rights.
"I've never seen that before," the agent told her. "You must know where all the skeletons are."
Lawner's understanding was that the primary intention of the payout was to prevent her from talking to the press. Despite the fact that Lawner was a behind-the-scenes figure, tabloid items surfaced about her, claiming she was difficult to work with. Lawner told friends that she believed she'd been smeared because of her refusal of Lauer's overture. When I asked Lawner about NBC, she told me she was unable to comment on her time there. NBC disputed the idea that Lawner's payout was related to her complaint about Lauer, but the network appeared to harbor some awareness of the connection. In 2018, as a Daily Beast reporter named Lachlan Cartwright pursued a story about NBC's purported pattern of settlements with sexual harassment victims, Stephanie Franco, the senior employment lawyer at NBC Universal, contacted Lawner's lawyer to remind her of the existence and enforceability of her pact. NBC's legal team would later say that the call was in response to a query from Lawner's attorney and provided notice of Lawner's release of legal claims rather than any non-disclosure provision. The settlements continued in the years after. In 2017, the senior member of the Today Show team I'd seen crying on set a year before received a seven-figure payout in exchange for signing a non-disclosure agreement. In communications that I reviewed surrounding the contract, attorneys emphasized that the promise of silence was the primary objective, not an incidental provision. As her contract with the network ended, she'd raised harassment and discrimination concerns, though the network said that the payout was unrelated to any specific complaint. She had also mentioned Lauer and sexual harassment to one senior vice president, though she didn't share with them the material I later reviewed that showed Lauer had left voicemails and sent texts that she saw as passes at her. When he took her responses as a cold shoulder, she felt he'd retaliated against her, spreading negative rumors in the office. Chapter 56. Zdarovia. The complaint that prompted Lauer's firing ended in the same way, with a payout and a non-disclosure agreement. When we first spoke, Brooke Nevels, the unnamed colleague whose story NBC leadership and the press had deemed a consensual affair, doubted she'd ever be able to go public. As I stepped out of hard rain into her New York apartment, she kept an eye over my shoulder until she locked us in.
"I just live in terror," she said. "And after your story about the spies, I got even more scared. I knew who I was up against and the shady shit they did."
She was in her early 30s, but with a gangly, adolescent quality.
"Tall, awkward, and flat-chested," she said with a laugh.
In her apartment, art and books were everywhere. As in a Murakami novel, cats were everywhere. Nevels had six until that morning, when one had to be put down due to kidney failure. She told me this with the affectless delivery of someone who had been through too much. Over the course of the past 2 years, Nevels had attempted suicide. She'd been hospitalized for post-traumatic stress disorder, descended into heavy drinking, pulled herself back. She'd lost 14 pounds and gone to doctors 21 times in a single 10-month period.
"I've lost everything I cared about,"
she said.
My job? My goals?
Nevels was raised in the suburbs of Chesterfield, Missouri. Grade school report cards said she spoke up a lot, smiled a lot, had a sharp sense of humor. Her dad was a Marine in Vietnam, earned a PhD in marketing, and became a civilian contractor for the Pentagon. Her mother, a TWA flight attendant, died of a heart attack a little over a year before our meeting. Nevels told me that her mother was just that kind of person that wanted the world to be better. Nevels had wanted to be a journalist since she was 13 and learned that Hemingway wrote for the Kansas City Star. You go into journalism because you believe in the truth, that people's stories matter. She frowned. Rain drummed at the windows.
I believed we were the good guys.
After college at Johns Hopkins, she interned at a few newspapers. In 2008, she got her dream job as an NBC page, the network's career development program. Over the following years, she worked her way up from giving tours to helping with big stories and staffing big stars. In 2014, she was doing just that, working for Meredith Vieira, a personal hero of hers on whose career she hoped to model her own. When Vieira got tapped to cover the Olympics in 2014, the two headed off to Sochi, a coastal resort city in Russia. At the end of one of their long workdays, Vieira and Nevels hit the bar at the luxury hotel where the NBC team was staying. They laughed and gossiped over martinis. It was late, midnight maybe, when Lauer walked in and scanned the bar for familiar faces.
I had always been so intimidated by him. He really was kind of a bully at work. Had we not been in such a happy mood...
She trailed off. But the women were in a happy mood. And they'd been drinking. She patted the low seat next to her, invited Lauer to join. Sitting down next to her, Lauer surveyed the martinis and said,
You know, what I really like is a nice cold vodka.
He ordered shots of Beluga vodka. Nevels had six.
Nazdorovia,
Lauer cried, literally to health. When Lauer took out his iPhone and started snapping pictures, Nevels felt some worry seep into the fun. Lauer was known for jokingly putting after-hours photos of colleagues on air, part of a prankster culture he presided over at Today. Nevels felt drunk and worried she looked it in the photos. After they parted ways, Lauer to his room, the women to theirs higher up in the hotel, Vieira grinned and produced Lauer's official press credential that granted him access to the events they were covering. Vieira and Lauer had a teasing, sibling-like rapport. This was the latest in a long history of mutual pranks. The women called Lauer and asked, between fits of tipsy laughter, if he was missing anything. Nevels recalled Lauer asking if she had looked for her credential lately. He had it. Nevels went to Lauer's room, a massive suite with wide views of the Black Sea, to retrieve her credential. She found him still professionally attired, and the two had an uneventful exchange about the credential heist. Nevels noticed his fancy stationery with Matthew Todd Lauer in raised navy ink and thought about scrawling "sucks" underneath as another drunk prank, but decided against it. Lauer was at times formal and high-handed with junior staff like her. She'd been watching him on television since she was 13 years old. She worried she'd get in trouble. Nevels went back upstairs and, as she and Vieira said their goodnights, texted one to Lauer, too, with a joking reference to the trouble the women were having drunkenly fitting their key cards into their doors. A few minutes later, as Nevels was brushing her teeth, her work BlackBerry buzzed. A message from Lauer's work email suggested that she should come back downstairs. She replied that she'd only come if she could delete the photos of her looking drunk at the bar. He told her the offer expired in 10 minutes. Later, sources close to Lauer told me that he considered her concern about the photos to be a thin pretext and her messages to be come-ons. Nevels said she found the idea of flirting with Lauer unthinkable. She had intended the messages to be playful, in line with his rapport with her and Vieira throughout the night. In retrospect, she considered going into a man's room at night by herself unwise. She said that she was drunk, didn't consider the implications deeply, and had no reason to suspect Lauer would be anything but friendly based on prior experience.
He always treated me like a little sister, she said. I had been to his room many times.
She didn't put herself together before heading down.
She was still dressed for work, in maroon jeans from Uniqlo, a baggy green sweater from Target, and one of the Nike Sochi Olympics jackets that had been handed out to NBC staff. She hadn't shaved her legs for weeks. She said that she assumed she'd be right back up. In her apartment, years later, Nevels tried not to cry and did so anyway.
I do this PTSD therapy, right? Every week, a different thing messes me up. I just get so angry how this one thing derailed my life.
When Nevels arrived at his door, Lauer had changed into a t-shirt and boxers. As he pushed her against the door and began to kiss her, she became aware of how drunk she was. She recalled the room spinning.
I thought I was going to throw up, she said. I kept thinking, I'm going to throw up on Matt Lauer.
She said that she felt acutely embarrassed about her baggy clothes and unshaved legs. She recalled Lauer pushing her onto the bed, flipping her over, and asking if she liked anal sex. She said she declined several times, replying at one point,
No, that's not my thing.
Neville said that she was still in the midst of telling him she wasn't interested when he
just did it.
Lauer, she said, didn't use lubricant. The encounter was excruciatingly painful.
It hurts so bad. I remember thinking, is this normal?
She told me that she stopped saying no, but wept silently into a pillow. After Lauer finished, Nevels recalled him asking if she liked it.
Yes,
she said, mechanically. She felt humiliated and in pain. She told him that she needed to delete the drunk photos of her, and he gave her his phone to let her do so. Did you tell Meredith anything? She remembered him asking.
No, she said.
Don't, he told her. Nevels wondered if it was advice or a warning. Back in her room, she threw up. She took off her pants, passed out. When she woke up, blood was everywhere, soaked through her underwear, soaked through her sheets.
It hurt to walk. It hurt to sit.
She was afraid to Google the problem on her work devices. Later, she was afraid to get tested for sexually transmitted diseases. What would her boyfriend of 5 years say? She bled for days. Neville said that, regardless of Lauer's interpretation of their exchanges before and after, what transpired in his room was not consensual.
It was non-consensual in the sense that I was too drunk to consent, she said. It was non-consensual in that I said multiple times that I didn't want to have anal sex.
The next day, Lauer emailed her a joke about her not writing or calling. Nevels told him everything was fine. She told me that she was terrified she'd angered him, a concern that deepened as he appeared to ignore her for the remainder of the trip. When she finally worked up the nerve to call him, he said they could talk back in New York. On their return, she said that Lauer would ask her to his palatial Upper East Side apartment, where they had two sexual encounters, and to his office, where they had more. Sources close to Lauer emphasized that she sometimes initiated contact. What is not in dispute is that Nevels, like a number of the women I'd spoken to, had several further sexual encounters with the man she said assaulted her.
This is the thing I blame myself most for, she said. It was completely transactional. It was not a relationship.
Nevels told friends at the time that she felt trapped. Lauer's position of authority over both her and her boyfriend, whose brother worked for Lauer, made her feel unable to say no. She said that in the first weeks after the alleged assault, she attempted to convey that she was comfortable and even enthusiastic about the encounters. She even tried to convince herself of the same. She readily admitted that her communications with Lauer might have appeared friendly and obliging. But she also said that she lived in terror of Lauer jeopardizing her career and that the encounters caused anguish and shame that eventually prompted her to break up with her boyfriend. She said that she successfully avoided the encounters for several months, but ultimately, she found she had to interact with Lauer for professional reasons. In September 2014, when Vieira was decorating her talk show set with photos from colleagues, Lauer's assistant told Nevels to come to Lauer to collect his pictures. At 9:30 a.m., in the little secondary office over the Today Show studio, where he and I had sometimes met, he pointed at an electronic photo frame Savannah Guthrie had given him, set on a deep ledge in front of the window. It's on there, he told her. She had to bend over the ledge to reach it. She said that, as she shuffled through the photos and emailed them to herself, He grabbed her hips and fingered her. She told me that she was just trying to do her job.
I just went numb. In my internal narrative, I failed because I didn't say no.
Neville's bruises easily. Lauer left dark purple marks where he'd forced her legs open. Crying, she ran to the new guy she'd started seeing, a producer who was working in the control room that morning, and told him what had happened. That November, she volunteered to put together a goodbye video for her ex-boyfriend, who was leaving a job at the network. Such videos were a common gesture for departing employees and usually featured well wishes from talent. When she asked Lauer for his, he told her to come to his office to record it herself. When she arrived, she said, he told her to go down on him.
I was really upset. I felt terrible, she told me. I was trying to do this nice thing, and I had to give Matt a blowjob to get him to film a goodbye video. I just felt sick.
She recalled asking,
why do you do this?
And Lauer replying, because it's fun. The sexual encounters stopped after that. She said that once, a month later, as she was grappling with depression and felt fearful about where she stood with him, she sent him a text asking if he was in New York. He replied, saying he was not. Neville's told,
like a million people,
about Lauer. She told her inner circle of friends. She told colleagues and superiors at NBC. As in so many of the stories I'd reported on, Neville's told some of them a partial story, skipping over some details. But she was never inconsistent, and she made the seriousness of what had happened clear. When she moved to a new job within the company, working as a producer for Peacock Productions, she reported it to one of her new bosses there. She felt they should know, in case it became public and she became a liability. This was no secret. And then, for several years, nothing happened. She didn't know about the pattern of harassment allegations within the company or the payouts and other appeasements that had concealed them. She didn't know that control of Peacock Productions, specifically, had once been handed over to Corvo's accuser.
If the Weinstein accusers hadn't talked to you, I never would have said a word,
Neville's told me.
I saw myself in those stories, and when you see the worst part of your life in the pages of The New Yorker, it changes your life.
As the momentum around the Weinstein story accelerated, colleagues started asking Neville's questions about Lauer. Over drinks, one Today Show colleague inquired about how much Neville's appeared to have changed. Neville's, previously as confident and outspoken as her grade school report cards had projected, had withdrawn. She'd passed up work opportunities, fearing her experiences with Lauer would come up if she stuck her neck out. She started drinking heavily. After years of orienting her life around long-term committed relationships, she fell in and out of them. Neville's told the Today Show colleague everything.
This is not your fault,
Neville's remembered the colleague saying, bursting into tears.
And trust me, you're not alone.
The colleague had her own experience with Lauer and professional fallout from it afterward. The colleague told Neville's she had to tell Vieira. And soon, Neville's was at Vieira's apartment, recounting the whole story again.
It's Matt, isn't it?
Vieira asked at the outset of the conversation.
I was thinking about it, and he was the only one who had enough power over you to do that.
Vieira was distraught. She blamed herself for not doing more to protect Neville's and feared there were more victims.
Think of all the other women I've gotten jobs there,
Vieira said. Neville's just kept apologizing. Both women knew how far the network would go to shield its top talent, but Neville's felt she had to do something to protect other women. Vieira said if she was going to do anything, she should file a formal report with NBC's Office of Human Resources. And that's how, in November 2017, Neville's found a lawyer and wound up sitting with him opposite two women from NBC Universal, telling the whole story. She asked for and was promised anonymity. But she left out nothing. She disclosed the ongoing contact afterward, but made it clear it was no affair. She described the incident in detail, making it clear that she'd been too drunk to consent and that she'd said no to Lauer's request for anal sex repeatedly. She was still early in her process of reliving the trauma. She didn't use the word rape that day, but she described one unambiguously. Her attorney, Ari Wilkenfeld, paused the proceedings at one point to reiterate that the interaction was not consensual. One of the representatives from NBC replied that they understood, though later the network would say that it had reached no official conclusion on the matter. Stephanie Franco, the NBC Universal lawyer who had placed the call reminding Lawner's attorney of the enforceability of her settlement, was present for the meeting. At work a few days later, when Nevels learned that Lack and Oppenheim were emphasizing that the incident hadn't been criminal or an assault, she left her desk, walked to the nearest bathroom, and threw up. Her distress deepened as articles to which NBC's communications team contributed began labeling the incident an affair. Angry letters began flooding her attorney's office.
"Shame on you for throwing your cunt at a married man," read one.
Nevels's work life became torture. She was made to sit in the same meetings as everyone else, discussing the news, and in all of them, colleagues loyal to Lauer cast doubt on the claims and judgment on her. In a Dateline staff meeting, Lester Holt asked skeptically, "Does the punishment fit the crime?" Soon, colleagues were averting their eyes in the hallways. After the items characterizing the relationship as an affair, her boyfriend at the time became sharply less supportive, asking her,
"How could you?"
NBC management had turned her into a pariah.
"You need to know that I was raped," she told a friend, "and NBC lied about it."
The network appeared to be doing little to protect Nevels's identity. Lack announced that the incident had taken place in Sochi, narrowing the potential complainants to a small group of women on that trip with close proximity to Lauer. A member of the communications staff identified Nevels by name in conversations with colleagues. Sources familiar with the matter later said that Kornblau had warned that member of his team not to do so. Wilkenfeld publicly accused NBC of outing Nevels.
"They know exactly what they've done, and they need to stop," he said.
Nevels hadn't initially asked for money. She'd wanted to do right by other women, then carry on with a job she loved. But as public scrutiny of the story and of Nevels mounted, NBC offered her 1 year's salary to depart and sign a non-disclosure agreement. Nevels felt her reputation had been damaged. She was grappling with losing both the job she loved and the possibility of finding future employment. She threatened to sue the network, and a protracted and punishing negotiation commenced. Sources familiar with the talks said that lawyers working with the network argued that Nevels's distress flowed from her mother's death and was unrelated to the alleged assault. In the end, her lawyer told her not to mention grief to her therapist, fearing NBC might subpoena her therapy records. The network would later deny that it made the threat or raised her mother's death. As the negotiation stretched over the course of 2018, Nevels took medical leave. Eventually, she was hospitalized for post-traumatic stress and alcohol abuse. In the end, NBC wanted the problem gone. It offered Nevels a growing settlement sum, 7 figures, finally, in exchange for her silence. The network proposed a script she would have to read, suggesting that she had left to pursue other endeavors, that she was treated well, and that NBC News was a positive example of how to handle sexual harassment. The sources familiar with the talks said that the network initially sought to include a clause that would have prevented Nevels from talking to other Lauer accusers, but Nevels pushed back. The network later denied they'd pressed for the provision. Lawyers closed ranks and pushed Nevels to take the offer, as they had with Gutierrez and so many other women. For Comcast, the sum was a rounding error. For Nevels, it was a matter of survival. She surveyed the professional future she had lost and the damage she felt the network had done to her reputation and felt she didn't have a choice. NBC took the extraordinary step of having not only Nevels, but also her lawyer and others close to her sign away their right to ever speak about the network. Chapter 57. Spike. The allegations about Lauer weren't the only ones emerging. From the first days after the Weinstein story broke, NBC had been buffeted by allegations about men in its upper echelons. Shortly after the first New Yorker story about Weinstein, the network fired Mark Halperin, MSNBC and NBC News' most prominent political analyst, after 5 women told CNN he had been harassing or assaulting women in the workplace, grabbing, exposing himself, rubbing an erection against one woman, dating back to his days at ABC more than a decade earlier. Days later, NBC fired Matt Zimmerman, the senior vice president of booking at the Today Show, and a close confidant of Lauer's for sleeping with two underlings. Less than a month after the Lauer story broke, multiple outlets reported that the network had paid an assistant producer $40,000 in 1999, after she raised a verbal harassment allegation against Chris Matthews, one of MSNBC's biggest stars. More news followed. There had been the large-scale payout to David Corvo's accuser during his involvement in the Weinstein story, and there was a more startling claim that shook me personally. Three women had accused Tom Brokaw of unwanted advances many years earlier. These weren't claims of assault, but co-workers, at times young ones, beginning their careers as he was at the apex of his, said he'd propositioned them and that they'd felt frightened. Brokaw was furious, heartbroken, denied it all. Practically alone among the prominent figures of NBC News, Brokaw had objected to the killing of the Weinstein story. He'd told me how he'd protested to the network's leadership. In one email to me, he called the killing of the story NBC's self-inflicted wound. But both things could be true. Tom Brokaw, a principled defender of a tough story, had also once been part of a network news culture that made women feel uncomfortable and unsafe, and left little room for accountability around its larger-than-life stars. 6, and then 12, and then dozens of current and former employees gave me a similar account of a permissive atmosphere when it came to harassment by prominent men at the network. Several of the employees said that they believed the years-long pattern of settlements had allowed the behavior to continue. Some said that the problems had deepened under Andy Lack's leadership. When Lack began his first tenure as president of NBC News in the 90s, it was a fundamental shift of, all of a sudden, a tolerance for abusive behavior, whether it was sexually harassing or it was just verbally abusive, Linda Vester, who raised the first complaint about Brokaw, told me. Degrading, humiliating talk, mainly to women, and that became the climate under Andy Lack. It was very stark. All of the employees said that they were concerned about the effect the pattern of complaints and settlements had on the network's coverage. That knock-on effect, said Vester, was one of Lack's trademarks. He would spike stories about women, she told me, and this happened routinely. NBC was embattled. Over the course of 2018, investigative stories in The Washington Post, Esquire, and The Daily Beast described a culture of harassment at the network. As The Post prepared to report that Ann Curry had told NBC executives about Lauer sexually harassing women, Stephanie Franco, the same NBC Universal employment attorney who had attended the meeting with Nevels, called Curry. Franco, as Curry recalled the conversation, wanted to know what she was telling the press. It was really a call to try to intimidate me, Curry said. That was my impression. Dismayed at what she took to be a focus on silencing her rather than addressing the sexual harassment problem at the network, she became direct. You need to be taking care of these women, Curry told Franco. This is your job. You should be making sure that these women are protected from this guy. Huh, I try to do that when they let me do it, Franco said. Later, the internal report on Lauer would cite the call to Curry as part of its research. Curry said Franco made no mention of a report and asked no questions about sexual harassment at the network. Several of the current and former employees recalled other instances in which the network appeared to be working to forestall disclosures. In one case, NBC hired as a paid contributor a reporter who had, until just before the hiring, been making calls to women at the network inquiring about harassment. One of the women the reporter had contacted texted me, "Cover up." No publication had circled the sexual harassment claims at the network and the allegations against Lauer more closely than the National Enquirer. Over the years, the tabloid had pursued Lauer's accusers. In 2006, when Addie Collins was working as a local anchor in West Virginia, she came home to a stakeout. A reporter from the Enquirer approached, peppering her with questions about Lauer. After his firing, the tabloid focused on Nevels, whose name was not yet public. It was her resume that had been attached to the internal emails at AMI that I later reviewed. Soon after she registered her complaint, the Enquirer began calling Nevels' colleagues and, eventually, Nevels herself. In May 2018, after the meeting in which Oppenheim and Harris tried to explain the internal investigation of Lauer to a skeptical investigative unit, William Arkin, one respected member of that unit, called me, troubled. He said that two sources, one connected to Lauer, the other within NBC, had told him that Weinstein had made it known to the network that he was aware of Lauer's behavior and capable of revealing it. Two sources at AMI later told me they'd heard the same thing. NBC denied any threat was communicated. But there was no doubt that the allegations against Lauer and NBC's wider use of non-disclosure agreements with women who experienced harassment were under threat of exposure during our reporting. That precarious culture of secrecy made NBC more vulnerable to Harvey Weinstein's intimidation and enticement, delivered through lawyers and intermediaries, and calls to Lack and Griffin and Oppenheim and Roberts and Meyer that the network initially concealed. That pattern of non-disclosure agreements and ongoing threats to enforce them was playing out as the network acquiesced to Weinstein's argument that his own similar pacts were ironclad and couldn't be reported on. And as Weinstein huddled with Dylan Howard, all these secrets had been under threat. The Inquirer had pulled Lauer's file and called one NBC employee after another with questions about him and begun to run articles that threatened the future of the star anchor who had become synonymous with the network's value. Chapter 58. Launder. Rich McHugh spent the year grappling with the fallout from the story, too. In his meeting with Oppenheim, he'd declined to yield to the network president's characterizations of the reporting and watched Oppenheim grow agitated and curse at him and wondered what the implications would be for his future. As he continued to speak up in the group meetings, McHugh said, "I was basically put on watch." HR began to call, offering him a raise to stay and, he felt this after the meeting with Oppenheim, sign on to the party line. On the other hand, the network reminded him that his contract was about to run out. "No one knows my name," he told me, sitting at the corner diner near my place on the Upper West Side. "They can say whatever they want about me. They can keep me from getting a job." "Do what's best for your girls," I said. McHugh shook his head. "I don't know if I can." Bringing up the family was no use. It was the man's conscientiousness about the world his daughters were stepping into that had prompted these fits of principle in the first place. In the end, he decided he couldn't take the money. "I sat in the meetings while they lied to the rest of the people," McHugh said, "had to bite my tongue, and then decided not to." A year after he was ordered to stand down on the Weinstein reporting, McHugh resigned. Then he gave an interview to the New York Times, saying that the reporting had been killed at the very highest levels of NBC, that he'd been ordered to stop taking calls about the story, and that the network had lied about what happened. Mark Kornblau and the NBC News public relations machine went apoplectic. Lack, resisting calls for an independent review as he had in Lauer's case, released to the press another self-report. I sat in one of the glassed-in offices at the New Yorker and read his memo and wasn't sure what to make of it. Later, the network would acknowledge that it had conducted no fact-checking on the memo. Within hours of its release, many of the sources discussed in it had made public statements disputing its contents. "Farrow never had a victim or witness willing to be identified," the memo said repeatedly. This was not true at any point in the lifespan of the story at NBC. "Ombra had always been willing to allow Farrow to identify her by name and use the recording of her, and I had filmed an interview in silhouette," Nestor wrote in a furious statement she released to the press shortly after the Lack memo went out. "After Rose McGowan pulled out of the story, realizing that the story was in peril of not being made public at all, Farrow and I discussed, and I had tentatively offered either to attach my name to the interview in silhouette or potentially even reshoot the interview with my face visible. However, they were not interested in this interview." Gutierrez added, "I was as available to Ronan before he left NBC as I was after he left. Nothing about me has ever wavered." Rose McGowan gave a statement to Megyn Kelly's program, reiterating that she'd been on the record for months. The memo contained a long tract in which Lack and the communications team attempted to undercut and dismantle the credibility of the sources. They dismissed Abby X's recollections of Weinstein's meetings designed for sexual entrapment by saying that her account was based on suspicion alone. X, too, released a statement saying this wasn't true.
"That is factually incorrect," she wrote. "Harvey asked me many times to join these meetings, to which I refused. But I was a witness to them, and in fact was a first-hand witness to physical and verbal abuse at his hands as well, all of which Ronan has on camera from my interview."
The memo suggested that Dennis Rice, the marketing executive, hadn't been referring to Weinstein, and that my use of his quotes had been misleading. In fact, Rice's statements had been designed to give him plausible deniability in the event that he faced retaliation, and he'd approved of how his quotes were used. Rice told a reporter that McHugh and I didn't take anything out of context. I always knew what I was saying on camera would end up in a story about Harvey. The New Yorker had later used these accounts without incident. Lack's memo was a misleading and incorrect account, X wrote, expressing bewilderment at the network's effort to attack and expose sources without consulting them.
To see this memo leaked to the press with the sources listed, even without our names, and without the full and honest picture of the reporting feels like the opposite of honest and direct.
The memo copped, for the first time, contradicting earlier communiques to the press, to Weinstein's numerous calls and emails to Lack, Griffin, and Oppenheim. It painted a portrait of those conversations at odds with the records I'd later uncover and the accounts of those who had stayed on the line while they played out. It made no mention of Griffin's assurances to Weinstein or of the warm rapport implied by a bottle of Grey Goose. Several investigative reporters at the network said they found the memo's focus on picking apart the work-in-progress reporting baffling. A number of television journalists I consulted agreed that the audio in and of itself was worthy of air. But McHugh and I hadn't argued that the story was finalized at NBC, or that it didn't have room to grow and come to fuller fruition, as it did in just a few weeks at The New Yorker. The problem, rather, was that we received a hard order to stop that development. Lack's memo made no mention of Greenberg ordering me to cancel an interview, blaming Oppenheim. It omitted McHugh being told to stand down, and Oppenheim being the first to suggest sending the reporting out the door to a print outlet.
"It's immaterial," one veteran correspondent recalled telling Oppenheim and Greenberg in response to their protestations about how much we'd had. "I know what it looks like when we're trying to bring a story to air, and I know what it looks like when we're not."
The correspondent said that,
"Privately, the internal narrative is, we blew it."
The memo was greeted with similar skepticism in the press. On the network's own air, Megyn Kelly questioned NBC's self-reporting, joining the calls for independent oversight. Soon, she'd be gone too, fired after another conflagration over a racially insensitive remark. For the network, the firing had the added benefit of cutting off what several sources around Lack said were mounting tensions over Kelly's focus on Weinstein and Lauer. The memo was only one in a series of steps designed to rewrite the history of the story at the network. NBC also hired Ed Sussman, a Wikipedia whitewasher, to unbraid references to Oppenheim, Weinstein, and Lauer on the crowdsourced encyclopedia. "The Lauer matter," Sussman wrote, justifying one edit, "should be handled separately." He spun the material in NBC's favor, sometimes weaving in errors. In one edit, he proposed that the month between the Weinstein story being greenlit and running at The New Yorker be revised to several months. Other times, he simply removed all mention of the controversies.
"This is one of the most blatant and naked exercises of hard corporate spin that I have encountered in Wikipedia, and I have encountered a lot," one veteran Wikipedia editor complained. But Sussman often prevailed. He reasserted his changes again and again, with a doggedness that unpaid editors could not match. And he deployed a network of friendly accounts to launder his changes and make sure they stuck. Several Wikipedia pages, including Oppenheim's, were stripped of evidence of the killing of the Weinstein story. It was almost as if it had never happened.
Chapter 59. Blacklist. After the first New Yorker story,
I faced a dilemma similar to McHugh's. For a time, I did as I had uneasily promised during the argument with Oppenheim and Kornblau, and dodged questions about the story's history at NBC. On CBS, Stephen Colbert looked at me narrowly as I said I didn't want the story to be about me and changed the subject.
Part of this story is the story not being told for so long, he said, and you experienced the story not being told.
My sister called at the height of the evasive interviews.
You're covering for them, she said.
I'm not lying, I replied.
No, you're omitting. It's dishonest.
The low points between us flickered back to me. I remembered the hard years after I'd told her to shut up about her own allegation, walking into her room after she came back from the hospital, seeing her pull a long sleeve over the ladder of blood-red M-dashes on her forearm, saying I was sorry and that I wished I could have done more. Throughout that fall, the network followed up on Oppenheim's text dangling a new deal. You should counter however aggressively you need, he added. Griffin called my agents and said,
I'm his guy. What do we have to do?
Before the claims about him surfaced, Brokaw emailed after my media appearances to tell me, you've handled this perfectly. Now, the future. He called, saying the network had asked him to convince me to come back. I realized the offer might have to be over the top, but you should consider it. It's still a great place to do journalism. He said he felt confident the network would agree to a statement acknowledging what had gone wrong and a new set of guidelines to prevent editorial interference. I still just wanted my job back, and I believed in the values NBC News represented at its best. I convinced myself that maybe the killing of the Weinstein story was a one-off, not a sign of deeper ills. I said I'd hear the network out and told my agents the same. But with McHugh's refusals to compromise, and with each source who called to allege a pattern of harassment and settlements at the network, it got harder to go along to get along. From the early days after the Weinstein story broke, I'd been talking to a group of sources who described serial misconduct at CBS, an executive who was said to sleep with underlings and harass and assault others, a pattern of payouts to silence women, dozens of employees describing how the cover-up was distorting a news outlet's priorities. In the end, I didn't think I could report out the allegations against Leslie Moonves and the other CBS executives while shutting up about the pervasive claims streaming out of 30 Rockefeller Plaza. I told my agents to drop negotiations. The reprisal was decisive. With each of the AMI stories over the following months, I was invited to appear on MSNBC and NBC shows at all hours, and then, suddenly, uninvited. On-air personalities called upset, one near tears, to say I'd been unbooked over their objections on direct orders from Griffin. A senior executive at the network later said Lack had issued an edict, too. These people are insidious, one anchor wrote. I'm so angry. Then the executives were reaching out, saying they knew I had a book coming out. I'd managed to finish the foreign policy book I'd ignored for so long, and they'd be happy to consider having me back on air to promote it if I'd come in and reach a formal agreement about not rehashing the past. I called Maddow, who listened and said no one tells her how to run her show. And so it came to pass that, all through the 2 years after the Weinstein story, I appeared on her show and never again on any other NBC or MSNBC program. Later, as I finished work on this book, NBC's litigation department began contacting the publisher, Hachette. The last conversation I had with Noah Oppenheim in the aftermath of the story was a call he made. I spoke to him while pacing the strange safe house in Chelsea, Jonathan listening in the background.
I've become the poster boy for this, Oppenheim told me.
The backfire from his and Kornblau's dissembling statements to media reporters had flared into the political zeitgeist. On Fox News a few days earlier, Tucker Carlson had sat in front of a picture of Oppenheim and called for his resignation.
Let's be clear. NBC is lying, Carlson said. Many powerful people knew what Harvey Weinstein was doing and not only ignored his crimes, but actively took his side against his many victims. It's a long list, but at the very top of that list is NBC News.
He appeared to relish the chance to attack a mainstream outlet, Hollywood liberals, and a sexual predator all at once.
News executives are not allowed to tell lies, he said, as if he'd never met one.
As I paced, Oppenheim said, "You know, I just got a call this morning from NBC Global Security saying they need to send a police car to my house because of all the online death threats." He sounded angry, not afraid. "I've got 3 young kids who are wondering why there are cops out front." I said I was sorry to hear it. I meant it. "Even if you think that NBC was either cowardly or acted inappropriately or whatever, which you're entitled to feel, I hope that you would realize the way this has become personalized and hung on me is not fair or accurate," he added. "Even if you believe that there is a villain in this, that the villain is not me." He was agitated, talking over me. Everyone, it seemed, had some culpability for his predicament except him. When I told him media reporters were telling me their criticism was a result of Kornblau's blanketing the press with false claims, he wailed, "Kornblau works for Andy. He works for the news group. He doesn't work for me. He doesn't work for me." And then, "I can't tell him what to do. I can try and I have tried." When he said he'd never threatened me, I reminded him that Susan Wiener had explicitly done so on his orders. He shouted, "Susan Wiener is Andy's lawyer. These are not people who work for me." Later, others involved disputed that characterization of Oppenheim's authority as president of NBC News. "You keep saying you're the one who takes the hit and it wasn't you. So where does it come from?" I asked, finally. "My boss, okay? I have a boss. I don't run NBC News exclusively," he said, then seemed to catch himself. "You know, everyone was involved in this decision. You can speculate what Kim Harris's motives are. You can speculate what Andy's motives are. You can speculate what my motives are. All I can tell you is, at the end of the day, they felt like, you know, there was a consensus about the organization's comfort level moving forward." He reminded me, twice, that he'd revived my career after my show was canceled, that we'd been friends. He hoped we could get a beer and laugh about it all in a few months. I struggled to understand what he was asking for. Gradually, he let it out. "I'm just making a plea," he said. "If the opportunity ever does present itself for you to say that maybe I'm not the villain in all this, I would be grateful." And there it was, at the end of his arguments, an unwillingness not just to take responsibility, but to admit that responsibility might, in some place, in someone's hands, exist. It was a consensus about the organization's comfort level moving forward that stopped the reporting. It was a consensus about the organization's comfort level moving forward that bowed to lawyers and threats, that hemmed and hawed and parsed and shrugged, that sat on multiple credible allegations of sexual misconduct and disregarded a recorded admission of guilt. That anodyne phrase, that language of indifference without ownership, upheld so much silence in so many places. It was a consensus about the organization's comfort level moving forward that protected Harvey Weinstein and men like him, that yawned and gaped and enveloped law firms and PR shops and executive suites and industries, that swallowed women whole. Noah Oppenheim was not the villain. "I do not think you will be getting a beer with Noah Oppenheim in a few months," Jonathan deadpanned later. It was a sunlit afternoon back at his place in Los Angeles. "No more morning TV, I guess," I replied. I was increasingly realizing I'd be spending the next year chasing leads about CBS and NBC. "I'll take care of you, baby," he said. "I'll keep you in finery and smoothies." He hugged me around the middle like a kid hugging a stuffed animal. I laughed, put a hand on his. It had been a long year, for me and for us, but we hung in there. Later, when I decided some of that reporting would make its way into a book, I'd send him a draft and put in a question, right on this page. Marriage? On the moon, or even here on Earth? He read the draft and found the proposal here and said, "Sure." The first time I saw my sister Dylan after the stories began to break, she gave me a hug too. We were at her cottage in the countryside, near my mother and several other siblings, under a blanket of snow. A universe apart from the tempest of unfolding reporting. Dylan's 2-year-old daughter, looking uncannily like her mother, wearing one of her mother's old onesies even, cooed for something, waving her arms.
My sister handed her a pacifier with a little stuffed monkey attached to it, and we watched her bound off on wobbly legs. I shuffled through mental images of Dylan and me during our own onesie years and those that followed. Dressed up for school plays, waiting for the bus, constructing a magic kingdom together that no one could touch. I remembered us as we positioned those pewter kings and dragons, and a grown-up voice sounded, calling her away. Her startled look, too frightened. Her asking if anything bad ever happened to her, whether I'd be there. And me making a promise. In the countryside, with her daughter running around, she told me she was proud of the reporting. She was grateful for it. And here she trailed off. "No story for you," I said. When she'd spoken, as a child and again several years before all of this, she felt people had looked the other way. "Right," she replied. It was a time of newfound accountability, but for every story being heard, countless others weren't. Dylan was frustrated. She, like many of the sources who had suffered at the hands of the unaccountably powerful and whose stories now filled my inbox, was angry. And not long after, she joined the others, in industry after industry, and told the world she was frustrated too. She invited a TV crew into the cottage in the countryside, and they made the place as bright as an operating room. A news anchor beckoned her over, and Dylan took a deep breath and stepped into the light. And this time, people were listening. It was dusk when I filed into David Remnick's office at the New Yorker. I found him flipping through a document. "Oh," I said, reddening a little, "that was for me." I'd asked a colleague to print it and leave it for me to pick up. Notes, not a handout. Remnick's assistant had brought it over to him instead. "It's interesting," he said, a sly smile, a little mischief. We took seats near a big window with views of the Hudson. Remnick had been gracious, dispensing advice as I grappled with what to do next. He thought of me as a TV guy, perhaps a little too obsessed with seeing my face on screen. And maybe I was. "You don't want to keep doing this forever, do you?" he asked, gesturing toward the magazine's offices around us. But I realized I did. I pointed at the notes, the next wave of potential stories. Some were about sexual violence. There was the developing reporting around New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, about whom New Yorker writer Jane Mayer and I would eventually publish 4 allegations of physical abuse, prompting him to step down. There was the investigation into CBS, which would swell to include 12 claims of assault and harassment against Leslie Moonves, prompting his resignation, the first in this new era by a Fortune 500 CEO over such claims, as well as changes within CBS's board and news division. Other leads were about different forms of corruption, waste and fraud and cover-ups in media and government. Some you have seen, some you have not. He looked at the document again, handed it back to me. "Too much?" I asked. Outside of the window next to us, the sky was changing. Remnick looked at me.
"I was going to say, we have our work cut out for us."
In the months that followed, I wasn't sure those plans would include the claims about harassment at NBC. At the network, everything was in its place. The Wikipedia articles had been scrubbed, the self-reports declared definitive. The people who would claim otherwise had been paid and remained too frightened to risk their non-disclosure agreements. The men of NBC News had put in the last word about Brooke Nevels, who had an affair, who hadn't been assaulted, about whom the company had known nothing. Only not quite. In early 2019, I returned to Nevels and sat in her book-lined living room again. This time, I brought Lavery, the New Yorker fact-checker. Afternoon light streamed through the windows. Cats, white and black and gray, encircled Nevels. Among them was a new kitten, taking the place of the one she'd lost before. Nevels was leafing through letters her late mother sent her, meticulous notes in dreaming, swooping cursive, a mother's love for her daughter leaping off the yellowing pages. "My dearest, darling daughter," one read, "each time a door closes, another opens." Nevels felt she'd ruined her life by not shutting up, and she was increasingly convinced it was the right thing to do. "All the women before feel I am their fault," she said. "And if there were women after me, I feel that is my fault."
She told me she was willing to take another risk, to tell her story again for the sake of those women yet to come. As I prepared to leave, she looked me in the eye and repeated her answer to all my questions about the network. "I am obliged to tell you that I cannot disparage Andy Lack or Noah Oppenheim or any other employee of NBC News." I nodded. As I watched, a smile just began to turn the edges of her lips. In the end, the courage of women can't be stamped out. And stories, the big ones, the true ones, can be caught, but never killed. Epilogue. Not long after the meeting with Nevels, Igor Ostrovsky and I reunited at a French bistro on the Upper West Side. Sun fell through the window behind him over our little table. He looked exhausted, like he hadn't slept in days. I asked him what brought it all on, this crazy high-wire act of leaking information to me through the months.
"I like to be able to read the news and not think somebody's holding a gun to the reporter's head deciding what they write," he said. "Coming from a society where the news was controlled by those in power, I never ever want to allow this to happen to the country that gave me and my wife and my son a chance."
Turns out, his wife had just had a baby, a first-generation American boy.
"I happened to be at this intersection where we were following reporters whose stories I read, who I thought were doing something honest and good for society. If somebody wants to attack that, it's attacking my country. It's attacking my home."
I studied him. How strange, this speech from the man who spent a summer following me, trying to stop my reporting. Once he'd refused to take the polygraph for Black Cube, the infotactic jobs had stopped coming. Now he was hanging out his own shingle, Austro-Intelligence. He'd still be a private investigator, but there'd be a public service angle, he announced, proud and earnest, meaning it and wanting me to know he meant it. Perhaps he could help groups like Citizen Lab.
"Moving forward, I'm going to try to be more involved in this kind of stuff. To better society. To seek out these kind of actors. Try to expose them," he said. "You know, the press is as much a part of our democracy as Congress, or the executive branch, or the judicial branch. It has to keep things in check. And when the powerful control the press, or make the press useless, if the people can't trust the press, the people lose, and the powerful can do what they want."
Ostrovsky flicked through pictures on his phone, a far-off smile on his face. A mother, flushed and exhausted after birth. A new son, coming home. A father, imagining how good a man he could become for his family. A blue-gray cat with clever, lamp-like eyes, peering wonderingly at the new arrival. The cat's name, by the way, was Spy.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of Catch and Kill, Lies, Spies, and a Conspiracy to Protect Predators, written and read by Ronan Farrow. Produced by Lisa Kahn and Ronan Farrow. Directed by Lisa Kahn. Recorded by Michelle Figueroa at the Hachette Audio Studios, New York, and Ian Lehman at Outlaw Sound, Hollywood. Post-production by Christine M. Farrell. Catch and Kill is available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2019 by Ronan Farrow. Audio production copyright 2019 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.